point, once the engine shuts down, you better be on the ground.
Yeah. You have no other choice.
Yeah. Okay. About...
17 was different in the sense that we had incredibly good photography.
Ah, okay.
We had Apollo 15 orbital cameras. Yeah, they had the Gary Powers U-2 camera when he got shot down over Russia.
Oh, I see, yes.
That camera became declassified. And so we grabbed it and used it. NASA. And it was on Apollo 15, 16, and 17, photographing the moon's surface. And at 65 nautical miles away, it gave you 2-meter resolution.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So you could see a Volkswagen.
Yes.
And that really gives you a different capability in planning.
Mm-hmm.
We could see these huge boulders that roll down the sides of the Massifs. Some of them made it all the way to the bottom. And that's, of course, why we went to those specific boulders, because we could put them back up in the mountainside where they belonged.
Mm-hmm.
That way, maybe give a little better geologic context to the, what, the 8,000 or 9,000 foot high mountain face. How it was put together. That's optimistic dream.
Okay.
But that was one of the rationales. Why do we want to sample those big boulders? Because we know we're sampling something that wasn't born or grown right there near the bottom of the hill, but started from way the hill and gone up.
Yes.
And then the light map, so-called, which is a big landslide blast loose by big impacts, which made most of the big craters in the floor of the valley. It turns out that came from Tycho.
Mm-hmm.
So by pure luck, we were able to date when Tycho formed. And here we are a third of the way around the moon from it.
Wow. Okay.
So that made a great asset in interpreting and unraveling what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
What we did miss out, of course, was the 15 crew, when they went over that float, we're talking about these little dark craters, and I think they called them cinder cones.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think Al Ward was mentioning that.
Yeah, they'd seen that kind of thing in the field trips out in the Hawaiian Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And so we immediately jumped to the conclusion that, God, here's cinder cones.
Which would indicate some kind of like a volcanic, subsurface volcanic activity.
Right, blows up to the surface.
Yeah.
Throws volcanic ash around. Makes a big halo around these little craters.
Now they did find, I've seen pictures where there would actually be, this thing be about 3 feet high, it actually looked like this cone of debris or that had bubbled up or something. Do you know what those were? I mean, I don't have the photo number in front of me here, but it's like...
At the landing site you're talking about.
Maybe it was at the landing site.
Well, there are places that really resembled it. And how are you going to tell a meteorite crater from a volcanic crater? Both of them pile rocks up at the rim and make a hill.
Uh-huh.
Both of them make a hill with a hole in the middle. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
And when you're looking at it from orbit, how are you going to tell one from the other?
Okay.
You really don't have any good clues. The other thing about if you have a volcanic crater, it blows stuff up and has it fall back down. It'll make the crater walls on the outside then end up about 30 degrees from the horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can stack them up thousands of feet high if you have the volcano going long enough. So that's really your only good cue, is how big is the crater, does it have good steep walls on the outside. But none of these things are that big.
Okay.
So you don't have any unique criteria to say, yes, this is a volcanic crater, or yes, it's a meteorite impact crater.
Okay.
So we found there was at least one of them in the landing site. We deliberately went and sampled, and it turned out to be an impact crater. That's where they found the orange
assume they brought these samples of that back?
Oh, yes.
How did Schmidt
ran a car through it, even.
Okay. How did the soil look once it was back here? I guess all the soil is looked at in a vacuum, though, correct? With no air present at all.
That's right.
Have they done tests on samples that exposed to air? I mean,
they do their damnedest to keep these things from getting in contact with air.
Yes.
So I have never heard that they did actually do something like that when they are in soil.
Yeah, I was interested.
There's no reason to, because you look at it under a microscope and you can identify the crystals in the glass and do some simple chemical tests and you find out that, it's volcanic glass.
I know he has been a very big advocate. Jack Schmidt has been a big advocate of helium-3.
Right.
I'm currently reading his book to do a book review of it for the Space Review, which is an online weekly. So I haven't come across that.
He keeps promising me a copy of that book, and I haven't got it.
Oh,
yeah. Probably see it next week when I go to my daughter's Christmas in Albuquerque.
Oh, yes. That sounds like Christmas in Albuquerque. It's got a nice ring to it. You've always been based in New Mexico, haven't you?
Well,
You spent a lot of your life there.
Well, I've been my summertime principally because I taught geology here at the University of Texas in Austin for my whole career.
Yes.
Except for the 2 years I took off for the Apollo business. And that's where I'm sitting now, is in my office on campus.
Okay.
In Austin. And my work in New Mexico has been primarily during the summers. The first 5 or 6 summers we're working as an employee of the New Mexico Bureau of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
Now the New Mexico Bureau of Geology.
Yes.
Then I got involved teaching our summer geology field course up there, and then I had research projects in the Taos area, and then I'm taking all of the shuttle astronauts on a week's field trip up in that part of the New Mexico. It's got so many different kinds of geology beautifully exposed that you can do a hell of a teaching job in a very short time.
Well, it certainly has to be discouraging for the shuttle astronauts right now. Not knowing if or when, so a lot of them just continue to train and study, wondering when they'll go up. What I was interested in finding out, and what is an issue with me through this thermal engineer, his frustration is that they're starting to undergo studies now for this new vision for space exploration, and it's like, it's the not invented here syndrome. It's like, yes, we have a wealth of Apollo legacy information, but maybe 50% of the people he speaks with who are involved in these new studies actually bother to go back and either in any form of engineering or any lunar soil studies, or he's really appalled by this, and I am too. Have you been contacted at all because you represent a lunar, I call it a lunar legacy, and the others that worked on Apollo at the time who are still living, who can talk about their experience. Now, you've been interviewed, of course, but I mean, in terms of actually speaking to a person who was there and using their experiences to apply to their new efforts, have you been approached by anybody?
The last 4 or 6 years, I've modified my geology field trip for the new shuttle classes to say, okay, guys, we're standing, say, in a big gravel field. The gravels have been derived from the stream that brought them out of the mountains that are above them. You just landed on Mars, but you got an abort situation. Sample this place. You got 5 minutes before we got to go. And so I give them an exercise.
I was curious about that, because that's going to be the last chapter of my book, and one of the things I want to address in that chapter is, how do you, are the brains being picked of those who were there, either here or on the moon, and is it being applied to what you plan to do in the future? You know, that's one of the things I want to address here.
There's a fair amount of that going on down at Johnson Space Center, as far as I can tell.
That's good news.
And particularly the guys that are trying to design a spacesuit that's a hell of a lot better than the one we used on Apollo.
Yes.
And they've done well. Now, the gloves were incredibly...
That's what I've heard. That's Apollo. The first thing they want improved are the gloves.
Well, that's because they ended up with blood blisters under all their fingernails.
Yeah.
Because when you grab something, you just puffed out on your snowman.
Uh-huh.
You have to fight the spacesuit to grab something.
Right.
So when you're grabbing a sampling tool or a camera, well, of course the camera's hanging on a frame in front of them. But every day you have to hang on to something, you're fighting that damn thing. And all during the months before they went up, they'd be walking around with a tennis ball in their hand, squeezing it.
Yes.
Building up the forearm muscles so that they wouldn't be exhausted at the end of the EVA. They could get their spacesuit off.
Right.
So the glove problems are pretty well solved. And the flexibility, they can actually bend over now and touch the ground, which they couldn't do in the other ones.
I know, you can watch them try. It's like they've got to go down one leg.
Guys.
The other thing, too, was visibility. Sometimes they couldn't see past... I wouldn't say past their nose, but, of course, John Young could not see that his foot was wrapped around the heat flow cable, I guess. You certainly can't feel anything.
Yeah, and of course, the problem is you've got a big, bulky spacesuit.
Yeah.
And you need to be standing pretty well upright, or you're going to topple over.
Right.
And the cables were a real pain on the Apollo days. They don't lay flat. They were big, wide, many, many wires in this thing, in the seal thing, and they were brought to the moon all coiled up. So when you lay them out, they're still coiled. They're not laying flat on the ground. So you don't think about that until it's too late. You accidentally walk into it, and even then, you're not going to feel it, more than likely. And that was one of the big disappointments on 16, of course, when John accidentally ripped off the heat flow connector.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that caused us a lot of headaches. Since that was one of the, that may well have been the most important geological experiment on that landing.
Did you have a coronary when, you could watch the TV image of that happening, I guess. I can imagine. The clips just show him doing it, but I figured the scientists in the back room have to be screaming right about now. Don't do it. Look.
Can you imagine what the PI thought?
Oh, my.
There goes his whole experiment.
Yeah.
Well, they had big meetings on how can we fix that thing. They actually got the backup astronaut crew out on the rock pile there at Houston.
Right.
To see how long it would take to disconnect the cables and what have you.
Right.
And then, what do you got to grind the plastic away so you can get the wires exposed? Well, you got a lot of rocks.
That's right.
And eventually they decided there just isn't any way we can guarantee that this thing's going to work if we have them take it into the lunar module and work on it. We want them to rest, get some sleep.
Uh-huh.
And we had to redesign one of our traverses, so we got back to the command module. Back to the wires there so we could take them apart and take them in.
Uh-huh.
And that cost us 15 minutes that we could have used somewhere else at a greater distance. So that's just one of work perfectly.
That's great.
And I guess it's practice to make it perfect.
Yeah. Well, I had heard that even Chris Kraft and the upper management there were in a way relieved that there weren't any more missions because they were just waiting for something catastrophic to happen, and that they had had such good fortune. But it really isn't good fortune. It's everybody doing a very concerted job to make sure everything worked as best as it can humanly be made, I guess.
That's right. Boy, there was real dedication in those days.
Uh-huh.
Didn't matter who you talked to that was involved in it, they were in it 100%.
Uh-huh.
And I don't see that today.
Yeah.
And the old guys are sitting there waiting to retire. We should have retired them earlier.
Well, you're not the only one to have said that to me. It's just, in fact, I was reading something Chris Kraft had said. He had, I guess he had retired, but he was over there talking with somebody about the space station issue. And basically he was told, what's the hurry? There's no you know, there's a different mindset.
Yeah.
And I do hope this new vision for space exploration has a very different approach. It sounds like Dr. Griffin, he's really caught between a rock and a hard place here and having to make decisions on some things now, but it sounds to me like he's the right guy for the job at this moment in time.
I get the impression that same way.
Yeah.
He faces the problem of we're spending all our money in the rock.
Yeah. Yeah, it is that sucking sound you hear is the money
yeah.
going over to that. It is the expense of war, and it's draining the treasury of a lot of money that could be used for other things here. That's true.
And NASA's always so visible. They're one of the first that suffer cut, and yet their budget is minuscule when you look at the overall federal budget.
0.7%.
Yeah, we spend more money on cigarettes than we do on NASA.
Uh-huh. And I wrote an article for the Space Review about that. And if you give me, I think I've got your email address, but I'll email it to the link to you so you can read it. But basically, if you ask the man in the street, what is the one department of the government that comes to your mind? Name the first three. NASA will always be in the first three. You know, Pentagon, NASA, and maybe something else. And yet, it takes up such a small part of the government budget, yet if they fail, it's like everybody wants to beat up on NASA.
Oh, yeah.
If they succeed...
they succeeded.
Yeah, well, but that's their job, and they're supposed to, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody asks that of the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Highway Traffic and Safety Administration. I mean, you know what it's...
Corps of Engineers.
Yeah. So, I really do think they should get more funding, considering how important... See, the space program is a technology driver for this country.
Oh, man, you know it.
And Apollo had a profound impact on the quality of life in America for the next 30 years, and we're still feeling it, I think. In so many ways, just the medicine and the computers and everything you can think of, materials and everything you can think of.
And in the geological world,
yes.
It drove the development of high-quality scientific equipment that we can now analyze. Pieces of rock that's so damn small, you're just amazed.
Uh-huh.
And how clean are our labs?
Yes.
You know, in Apollo 11, they gave samples from one soil sample, split it up into a whole bunch of pieces, so everybody had the same amount, and shipped them out to these labs that study carbon.
Uh-huh. just go on and on, and Americans tend to forget this, I think.
That's right.
They don't realize how profound an impact our space program has on the quality of life for us here, and I think NASA needs to do a better job reminding people that, not just giving them a good dog and pony show, this is what we're going to do next, but this is why the space program is important to you, because if you don't have it, the quality of life of your children will be less than yours, or something like that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've got all these Earth orbiting machines now that are doing a good job collecting that kind of data.
Uh-huh.
Seeing how we're screwing up our world.
Uh-huh. Right. This big fire that's going off in, is it in France or England? I guess, because I know England is getting it, but maybe it's in France. I don't know.
England just had one of their big oil, I guess it's oil, fuel tank area blow up.
Oh, is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah, about 25 miles north of London.
Oh, man, that must be horrible.
Yeah, no fun.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've been the totally expected fount of information today. And I'm glad I had the privilege of talking with you, because I've seen you so many times over the years in various film clips and everything. And it's a thrill to actually get to talk with you on the phone.
Thank you.
I've had a chance to talk with all the astronauts except Harrison Schmitt. He's a busy guy, but I think he'll give me an interview for the chapter on Apollo 17. Because
I hope so.
If I do, I'm going to do a book review of his book, and it's a good read. Believe me, it's technical, but that's what you would expect.
Sure.
But and that'll go online, and as soon as the review is published online, I'll make sure I email you with a link so you can grab it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And hopefully, I'll get a copy of his book to you. I was surprised I got mine as soon as I did. I requested an advance copy. See, his publisher, Copernicus Books, is affiliated with my publisher, Springer Praxis.
Uh-huh.
And Springer Praxis publish, of course, a lot of scientific books and space exploration titles and that sort of thing. And this is my 10th book. All my other books have been of a earthly transportation nature. This is my first opportunity to go off world and write about stuff like this. So I'll be sure to get a copy of the book to you when it's finally published late next year.
Great.
And I appreciate you talking with me today. I went to the University of Texas at Austin website, and under your name, there's an email address listed. Is that a good address?
That must be, because that's what you got me on.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Oh, my. And I've got more Christmas shopping to do, too, so...
Lots of luck.
Well, I hope you enjoy your Christmas.
I'm sure. I intend to. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for talking with me today.
I know.
You bet.
Merry Christmas to you.
Thanks, and to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.